Good morning. Good to see you all. There's so much to talk about in this week's Parsha, but on the other hand, I'm trying to avoid just doing a Dvar Torah. It's not really what we do here, I think. I mean, we wind up talking a lot about the Parsha. The Parsha is really just a roadmap for us of where we're going, and every year it sort of takes us to another place, a lot of detours along the way. That's what makes life interesting. I remember once a wise-assed Hebrew school kid said to me, "Rabbi, you know, we read it last year. Why are we doing it again? Does Moshe make it this time? Is it going to change in any way?" I said, "No, he's still not going to make it. But we do it because ultimately, every time we go around and around and around, we create a new ring on the tree of life." And so the kid is a wise-ass kid. He said, "Yeah, why do you need another ring? Don't you have enough rings already? It's been around for a while." And I said, "No, you've got to understand, every time you build another ring, its trunk gets wider and wider. And the question is, why is that Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, having to get wider and wider? Because it has to support more and more and more and more branches above, because each of us is a branch in that tree of life. So it is now so voluminous, as we say, Kenainahara, so voluminous, there are many, many, many branches, not as much as we would like to have, but there are still quite a few. And now it's so voluminous that people on this side, if you will, on the left extremes and the right extremes, don't really agree about much, except one thing: they all claim to be coming out of the same tree of life. So there's no Jewish community in history that we know of, certainly Judaism. Remember, there is no Judaism before the destruction of the Second Temple. We have this thing called Judaism that's created, has at its core this tree of life. So every community has at least one Sefer Torah, at least, which they use, or many, you know, more wealthier communities have many, many. But the idea is that you can't have a Jewish community, no matter where you are on your interpretive spectrum, which can be very wide. You really have to always come back to that base, to the roots, if you will, of that tree of life, which gives us sustenance and gives us life. So that's the interplay between text and humans. You know, that we need the text in order to ground us, but the text needs us in order to fly. So it's really a very interesting way of seeing things. So this week's parasha has a lot in it. And a lot of a separate topic, because I don't have time to do everything, but you know, once you get into preparing for these things, you get into these remarkably good rabbit holes, and you wind up, you know, doing stuff about tantric sex in Nepal. But I don't know how we get to that. But the bottom line is you wind up talking about so many other things. I'm going to try to avoid that and save something for another session. But what I was interested in is just going through a bit of this parsha without any commentaries. Just this is what's going on, and it's very bizarre, and it operates within a rubric of transitions. So it opens up, it's Numbers 8, Bamidbar 8 to Bamidbar 12. It's called Be'ha'alotcha. It opens up with the lighting of the menorah as a symbol of spiritual clarity. Every morning it says that they would get up and they would light the menorah. The menorah is a seven-branched candelabra, if you will, in the Mishkan, in the dwelling place of the divine, and it is not the Hanukkah menorah, which shouldn't be called a menorah. It's a Chanukiah. It's not a menorah because it has eight. There's also the consecration of the Levites, which we started seeing at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, the Leviim and their tasks, and they are consecrated to be doing this ongoing service, the Levites, of transporting the Mishkan, the portable shrine. And then we're also told that the Levites are a substitute for the firstborn. If you recall earlier on, those you've been following, you're supposed to dedicate your firstborn, but that changed, and it would have been very different if I think the service of the Mikdash would have been very different if it would be basically a conglomeration of people from the 12 tribes, each, etc. But at a certain point, they went for a dynastic kind of system that you're born into, being a Kohen or a Levi. Then immediately in the parsha we have this thing that's quite important in a way. It's a beginning of what we would call accommodations. Yes, you have the Torah was given a while back, right? We had an interruption in the narrative in the book of Yikra, of Leviticus, but now we're back to the narrative of leaving Egypt. And the Torah has been given, but yet there's an accommodation. They've established last week, the week before Passover, but they have the idea of Pesach Sheni, interesting term, Pesach Sheni. Those who were unable to observe the first Passover for whatever reason are permitted to do another Passover meal, offering up a Paschal lamb, exactly 1 month after. So it's a dispensation, a grace period, if you pardon the expression. And then at this point also we learn about God's cloud guiding the Israelites. They're commanded to create silver trumpets. Where they got the silver fragrance, don't know. But that when you heard the silver trumpets, they would march off and they will depart from Sinai, where we had the last stop. And Moshe will ask his father-in-law, Yitro, to join them, but he will say no, he will return to Midian, where he was. Just a word about the traveling of the people of Israel at this point. They're not traveling in a long line anymore because of the encounters with marauders, Amalekites along the way. They're now traveling in a square, which has been described at the beginning of the book of Bamidbar. Finally, chapter 11 talks about people complaining. Yes, this is a very important thing, and it's the beginning really of a very difficult time for Moshe and Aaron. The complaints are about food. Hard to believe. This is not even the Catskills, right? But they're still complaining about food. Too much manna, or not enough variety. They want the manna. Well, now the manna, by the way, which is this manhu, they ask the question, what is this, when they see it in the morning? That's why it's called manna. According to the tradition, had the capacity of taking on every taste that it wanted. Some say it's sort of a kind of it was probably like tofu, that whatever you marinated in, it takes that taste. But you could get any taste you wanted out of it. But maybe it was an issue of texture. I'm not sure. They complain about it. God sends quail, and the quail are so voluminous, and they have so much that it comes out of their noses and becomes a plague, rather than a gift, but a plague. And that's interesting to consider. What is it if you get too much of what you want? Is that a blessing or is that a curse? Right? So, you know, you often get what you wish for. Then Moshe is in despair. Yes, we get to get a picture of Moshe was finally letting down and saying, I am tired of all of this. Better that you should get rid of me. I'm tired. I can't handle it alone. And like in the chapter of the giving of the Torah back in the Shemot and Yitro, Moshe is told to get help. And he appoints the 70 elders, and they are given the gift of prophecy, however that's to be understood. And then there are two people who are not part of that 70 who also get prophecy. And it's basically this idea that somehow Moshe can't bear it alone. And Moshe really at this point is in a state that we don't normally see him. He's overwhelmed, and he feels isolated, and et cetera, et cetera. He finally says, when he hears about the two people having prophecy in the camp who are not part of the 70 elders, he says, wouldn't it be great if they all could be prophets? I'd be out of a job. I think he's looking to be out of a job. So what is important, though, about the fact that there are people outside of the quote-unquote leadership rank who have prophecy is, again, the sense that this is trying to create sort of a community where everyone has access. And yet, right at the end of the Parsha, Numbers 12, we get this incident, which is really remarkable, of Miriam and Aaron speaking out against Moshe, criticizing for taking a Cushite wife, whatever that means. It's very complicated. Can't get into that. Miriam is struck with sara'at, which is the scaling of the skin. And Moshe is humility and prayer for healing. El na refan Allah has become part of our service every week. So there were questions that could be asked, obviously. I don't have all the answers. Neither do I think we need all the answers. We just need to have the right questions. In our tradition, questioning is probably more important necessarily even than the answers. I think with the future of AI, which is already in front of us, the future is here, it's going to be very important how you question, what questions you put in order to get the kinds of answers that you would like. So it's going to be very important. So let's go back a little bit. First, with Numbers 12, the end of the parasha with Miriam and Aaron speak against Moshe. I find it a bit mind-boggling why the Torah would include, or the people who put the Torah together would include, this sort of behind-the-scenes making of the sausage. You know, you rarely have, you know, why should they put in the fact that Moshe and Aaron are jealous and this and that? Isn't that stuff that should have happened in the home office quietly? Doesn't have to be public. So the question is, why is this done in a public way? Perhaps the reason is the about the effect of words and how words can be damaging, and of course that very famous plaintive prayer for healing. So it's a lot there, and one of the ways of understanding all of this, at least understanding is the wrong word, I can't understand it, but of taking it in, is that we're talking about a period where we're seeing already a breakdown of the culture, of the society, and it's because of this very, very strong sense of transition. And transitions always have within it a great anxiety, and this idea of anxiety seems to be a way of understanding a lot of the behaviors that we encounter, particularly the grumbling. We have a tremendous amount of grumbling, so that's important. So you have both anxiety, you also have fear, a lot of fear. You're going into the wilderness. So in this fear, they somehow begin to conjure up, if you will, some sort of memory of what was, and that memory of what was is a memory of wow, wasn't it great? There were, you know, back in Egypt we had this and this and this to eat, and here we are and we're stuck with eating tofu all day, etc. So it's interesting. Is this a result of fear, of anxiety, etc.? So they really reflect all of these chapters, and I'll open it up a little bit for more conversation. These chapters reflect the fragility of spiritual community and the burden on leadership and the constant tension in between the ideal and the reality of where we have a mission. Remember, this point in the narrative, keep this in mind, they are not supposed to be wandering for 40 years in the desert. Okay, that happens later on. As an ongoing part of this breakdown, we see the spies coming back with a negative report. Later the rebellion of Korach. It's really this. The next chapters are really about this dangerous, you know, kind of time when things could have disintegrated, etc. And what is the role of leadership? So this the fragility of spiritual community, the burden of leadership, the tension between ideal and reality, these, I think, are parallels that obviously we can draw into our lives, particularly our spiritual lives. So there's some possible questions that I want to open up for our discussion. Is once, how do we sustain a spiritual life when we're constantly in motion, we're constantly moving from one point to the other? We're always in transition, right? Always in transition. Second, what is the role of the leadership of a spiritual community? Is it to give, is it being on high, bringing down the word, or is the leadership of spiritual community there to empower everyone within the community to rise up? You would get a sense of that when Moshe says, if they only all could be prophets. Maybe that's really the idea of spiritual community, that it raises everyone up within it to create a holy community. And of course, the question that we ask ourselves every day and every week, particularly with the political situation we are in globally and in our own country, is how do we navigate disillusionment, complaint, and human failure? How do we get through this kind of anxiety of being in transition from birth to death. And that's something I think has been the been talked about only for thousands of years, but we continue it because within our spiritual community, we are always aware of the fact that when we concentrate on breath, when we get back to our basic breath, we are really at any moment, if you will, between life and death. When will be the last inhale? And aren't we pleased that we have an exhale? The inhale and then the exhale. So I could go on much more. Being an academic and a rabbi, I talk a lot, but I'd like to open it up for you as well. There's a lot to chew on, obviously, and I'll give you an open season. You can chew on what we have put out. You can chew on something else. If you're in the middle of chewing about something from before, you might want to chew a little now. So whatever chewing you're doing, we are the chewing people. Oh, no, the choosing people. I think that's what it is, the choosing people, not the chosen people. Remember that, we're not the chosen people. We're the choosing people. And that's something people forget, that, chosen, this is a separate top topic. So thanks for paying attention to my ramblings. And let's see if we can get some conversation going. Thank you.